For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Today we're debating the ethics of abortion, and we are starting right now with Kenan's opening statement. Thanks so much for being with us, Kenan. The floor is all yours.
Okay, so yes, I'm taking the pro-life side of this issue. Here is my opening statement. My position was formed at the age of 22 and hasn't really changed. Life begins at conception. Each human life is imbued with innate value, and no one has the right to decide whether it should die, unless, of course, there's some exceptional circumstance that I haven't really thought of. All the arguments I've heard in favor of abortion on demand have not convinced me. Each of them could easily be defeated by social or cultural changes. Worst of them is the idea that a newborn baby would suffer because of their living circumstances, as though we could predict this with any degree of accuracy. Again, I'm not satisfied by that argument. Perhaps the most common argument in defense of abortion on demand is my body, my choice, which is something that you hear protesters chanting in the street. The idea of a woman's autonomy, and I guess you could make it, or call it a private property argument. Regrettably, I'm not much moved by this idea for two reasons in the main. First, only in this matter is that phrase used, my body, my choice. The government, various governments around the world, impose limits on human bodies. There are things that you're not allowed to do to yourself or to anyone else. One could argue, and I would argue, that abortion on demand is it should be restricted. I'm happy to go into detail a bit later on that one. More tragically, and this is one that will upset any women watching this, I think it implies that a woman would ever have full control over her body and its processes, which is nonsense. I think any woman would attest to that. I'm not trying to make light of it, but there are certain biological factors of a woman's life, that she has no control over. So it is my belief that abortion on demand is another sign that cultures have become cold, callous, materialistic. Problems are there to be solved, not to be avoided. Abortion on demand releases all of us from any kind of responsibility. It releases society and the culture at large from any kind of social, material provision. And a person dies as a result of the procedure. James, that is my opening statement for good or ill. I pass it over to you or to Richard, whoever feels like speaking next.
You got it. Thank you very much, Kenan, for that opening statement. And want to welcome you, folks. If it's your first time here at Modern Day Debate, we are a neutral channel hosting debates on science, religion, and politics. We hope you feel welcome no matter what walk of life you are from. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button as we have many more juicy debates coming up. For example, Daniel Hakikachu and T-Jump will be debating next week on whether or not atheists are skeptically consistent. It'll be a juicy one. You don't want to miss that one. And hit that subscribe button so you don't. With that, thanks so much, Richard. The floor is all yours for your opening statement as well. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, James, for inviting me again. And thank you, Kenton. I had never been on TikTok until the last few days. So I don't know whether this is a great gift that you have bequeathed me or a horrifying curse. But I actually have been on TikTok for the last 48 hours or so, listening to your videos. thank you. But you're clearly a very successful TikTok content creator. You've made quite a stir over there, at least from what I can tell. So I would congratulate you on that.
Thank you.
I think the ethics of abortion, I will admit, are rather tricky. And I think they're tricky because we use reason to determine whether an abortion is ethical or not. And reason, although it is a magnificent tool, it is ultimately limited in its effects. And I think it's ethically limited, and it doesn't always give us bring us to the right path. And let me try to represent both sides of the argument fairly, and I'll I'll show where they really reach an impasse. Both are based on an idea of individual value of human life, and both are based on a basic kind of human rights concept. So from the pro-life side, you have a child in the womb, and whether that is a human being the moment the sperm hits the egg, or there is some point in its development where it could be considered a human being, I think we would all admit that it is a life form. It's a potential for a human life. I would, of course, admit that. And thus, making a decision on this child is making a decision for it, and in some way using force. I think violence might be overstated, but you understand what I'm saying. Making a permanent decision on its behalf that it bears no blame, it has no say. It just seems profoundly unfair, even if a teenage girl, as we have seen recently in a salacious news story from Ohio, even if a teenage girl were raped, that child is innocent in that case. And even though the circumstances are unimaginably terrible, he somehow still deserves a chance. That is the pro-life side. Now, the pro-choice side, again, using rationality and ethics.
Oh no!
So
you've broken up. You've broken up.
Have I?
On Kendon's side, you have. I've gotten it loud and clear. Kendon, I think one thing.
No. It's only for the last couple of seconds. You mentioned something in Ohio. A child was raped, and that's where I lost you. So could you just repeat the last couple of points? Thank you.
Sure. There was a teenage girl in Ohio that this became a salacious news story in the United States, particularly because we're debating Roe v. Wade and Hobbs and all that kind of stuff. A teenage girl was raped, and she had to actually travel to another state to have an abortion. So she's under the worst circumstances imaginable. But even in this case, the pro-lifer would say, that child has a right to live. That child did nothing wrong, and a choice is being made for that child. I think that's a fair representation of the pro-life side, and I understand where they are coming from. The pro-choice side uses effectively the same logic, and that is why an impasse is reached in these things. The female has control over her body. She is a sovereign, rational individual, and she can make these choices for herself. I'll just use an example. If a ne'er-do-well friend came to you and asked to stay in your house, and you, being a generous person, said, well, you can stay for the weekend. I'll put you up. I'll buy you some, you know, buy some groceries for you, get, you know, make sure that you're all right. And that weekend turned into a week, and then a month, and then 6 months and a year. At some point, you would have the sovereign right to kick that person out of your house. And what happened to him after that is really no concern. That is your house and your property. So both of these sides are based on human rights and individualism, and they are both in a way equally correct. Just moralistically, logically working these out, we're going to reach this endless impasse, as we have in the Western world, because it seems like the only way we can think is in terms of individualistic logic and human rights talk. Now, one thing that Kendon said that I think was very powerful was this notion of responsibility. I do think that we have a responsibility to the future. And I think that is the most profound responsibility that any of us have. And if you want to couch it as a responsibility to the unborn, our future inheritors, then that is a reasonable way of discussing it. we have a responsibility to leave them a world that is perhaps better than the one that we live in now. We have a responsibility to not leave them a world that is suffering from environmental devastation, resource depletion, and that is just generally unhappy. They should enjoy the things that we enjoy. They should maybe have more than we have. I think we should also bequeath them a population that is healthier, happier, more beautiful, and more intelligent than the one that we have now. And so we actually have to make hard decisions about our responsibility for the future. And these decisions really can't just be based on this kind of individualism and moral logic that both sides adhere to today. At this point, we are in effect breeding for low intelligence. We are breeding for heart disease. We are breeding for obesity. And if the pro-lifers and religious right get their way, we will in effect be breeding for rapists. We have to understand, as serious, scientifically informed people, that so much of our personality, so much of what makes us who we are, is heritable. That is, we are a lot like our parents in many ways. Now, of course, you can come up with tons of exceptions, and you know, a young boy born in poverty who invents the iPhone or something like that. But these are crazy exceptions. On the whole, we are very much like our parents in terms of our personality profiles and how we are going to get on in life. So we owe it to the future to make very tough decisions about what the population, the world population, is going to be like. People can make these in a rational and moral fashion through prenatal testing. Even in the United States, which has this, you know, tradition of religious fanaticism born out of our very early history, 60% of children who would be born with Down syndrome, those pregnancies are terminated. Now, you can say that that is done because people are cold and callous and selfish and evil, but I don't think that is at all the case. A lot of these are done by people who already have children, who are raising children, who are married, and so on. They are doing that so that we can have a better population in the future. All mating and dating is on some level eugenic. And when it's not eugenic, I think it is generally evil. That is, for your own daughter, you want her to marry a man who's intelligent and handsome and who can make it in life. You don't want your daughter, in effect, marrying, quote unquote, that is breeding with, a rapist or some chud that she, you know, meets at a bar and makes a mistake, mistakenly hops into bed with due to alcohol or just immaturity or something like that.
30 seconds left.
We all have a eugenic drive to build a better future. And that future involves the environment, it involves science and technology, but it also involves the population itself. And so we need to make decisions on that. Most abortions, 75% of abortions that are occurring right now in the United States, according to the Guttmacher Institute, are to people of lower income. And 50% of those people are below the poverty line. I think we owe those people who struggle, who are morons, let's just be frank, who can't really take care of themselves, we owe them this ability to have a life where they're not overburdened with children, they're not treating their children poorly, they're not abusing them, they're not neglecting them. We owe them that chance to have that ability to do that. And I think that is overall a good thing for society and the future. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much for that opening as well, Richard. We are going to jump into the open dialogue, folks. I want to say though, hey, if you happen to have friends who enjoy controversial debates like this, don't forget to hit that share button, share it to a group thread or something like that. as we have plenty more juicy ones coming up, just like this one, which we're I'm very excited for this one. Gentlemen, thank you very much. The floor is all yours for that open dialogue.
Okay, thank you very much, James. Right, so Richard, yeah, your opening statement was a lot longer and more detailed than mine. So I've been trying to scribble down notes, and I'm going to try and deconstruct as much as I can without just waffling on and losing the thread. I agree with you in the initial argument. You said that obviously relying on reason is tricky, because reason is indeed limited, and people often confuse logic with reason. You know, my cat has four legs, my chair has four legs, therefore my cat is a chair, which is perfectly reasonable, but also stupid and wrong. So yeah, there is a limited. We also have an emotional life that people don't really factor into these things. There is an emotional response to pregnancy. There's an emotional response to abortion, and we're not robots. We're not Vulcans. We do actually have an emotional sense that needs to be considered.
To things that are unreasonable. Mm-hmm. You could say
yes, absolutely.
You will sacrifice yourself for your child, for instance. That is irrational on some level.
Well, one could go one step further and suggest that all emotional connections are irrational by definition. They're meant to circumvent all higher brain function, including, you know, risking your life to save a child or, you know, anything like that. You are right as well. My entire philosophy is effectively based on individualism, which is, of course, a human rights concept. It's only been with us since 1948, if you think about it. Yes, it is a permanent decision visited on a child. I believe the child in the womb is indeed innocent and should be given some kind of chance. Just touching on the Ohio girl scandal, yes, you're right. I've said this in previous debates on this topic, on Modern Day Debate, in fact, that when it comes to the issue of rape, I'm something of a coward because I couldn't look a victim of rape in the eye and say, tough, you have to bear the child. I couldn't do that. And because I don't have the strength of will to do that, that would be, I'd turn a blind eye, which is morally inconsistent, but at least I'm honest about the inconsistency. The thing is that the phrase that really struck me initially in your answer was evicting a tenant. Now, I don't like this analogy. The idea that, you know, if someone comes around your house and stays for the weekend, you buy groceries, that's great. But then obviously, if they overstay their welcome, you get to kick them out. Ultimately, if they have nowhere else to go, you are responsible for their homelessness to a certain degree. But more importantly, if someone is to be evicted from your property, we do have social institutions and customs, I suppose you could use that word, to look after the life of someone who is homeless. Of course, if you evict the tenant of a womb, the tenant is dead. There's no way they can't survive outside the womb unless they're medically viable. They can still be premature, but even then it's still a risky business. So you're still responsible for the death of something. We have no means of keeping a baby alive outside of you. Maybe sometime in the future we will have such technology, but at the moment, if you evict a baby, it dies, and that's pretty much how that works. Yes, I mean, individualism is limited. We do have a collective social responsibility to the future. And you used the example of creating a better world for our descendants. The obvious question that I would ask is, how does one define better? And the trouble is that because I'm not a collectivist and I'm not an authoritarian, I'm not entirely sure that one size would fit all, even in with regard to national culture. I think most you are right to some degree, although I'm not comfortable with the word eugenics because of its obvious historical connotations. We are, to a certain extent, selective in our breeding partners. You know, we want people with certain physical traits, certain mental traits, maybe certain hobbies and interests, even, which indicate greater characteristics. So, yeah, to a certain extent, it is eugenicist. But there ought to be a limit, I reckon. There's no mathematical precision to this. It's entirely personal. So, yeah, better future on a local level for individual families, maybe. But as a nation state, no, I don't think it's manageable realistically. There's also the idea of, you know, because you said the phrase you used here, we're breeding for low intelligence, heart disease and obesity. Are we actually breeding for those, or are they just an inevitable consequence of sort of random genetic pairing? There's also
we are here, breeding for them effectively.
Well, okay, well, we can pick up on that in a minute. I've only got like 10 seconds now. You talk about relying on science to, you know, select against things like Down syndrome and that, but surely relying on science contradicts your opening statement because science relies upon reason. I don't know. Anyway, I wanted to go deeper into that, but I'm running out of time. So I think James wants me to stop talking now, so I will.
We'll kick it right back over to you.
Okay. Would you like me to respond, or could you give me maybe a direct question?
Yeah, that would really help.
Because you did about kind of four or five things there.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. I got one.
How do we determine what's good, basically? I think these things are kind of less controversial than you make them. Intelligence is valued in all cultures across all societies. I think sometimes you don't. I might want to quote Stephen Colbert here, who when he was giving a monologue before George W. Bush, he kind of played up that Bushism and said, you know, there are more neurons in your gut than there are in your brain. So that's not exactly true, but don't look it up in your brain. Look it up in your gut. He said a joke to something to that effect. I find very interesting, but I think he's kind of right in a way. We have a natural attraction to things that are beautiful and dynamic and intelligent. I don't think it's very controversial what is beauty and what is athleticism, what is strong and what is weak, what is healthy and what is sick. You know it when you see it. And so I think there's oftentimes this kind of moral blackmail or something of, you know, who decides, you know, kind of things. Well, yes, leaders of society will make decisions on these matters, but what actually is better and healthier and more beautiful is not actually terribly controversial. I think most normal people have a very strong sense of what kind of children we want in the future. And even yourself, I applaud your honesty, and I of course are totally on your side. A vile criminal rapist, not just your average rapist, which is bad enough, but someone who raped a child. You can't look at the woman in the face and say, your baby is innocent. And I think you know that baby isn't innocent at the end of the day. That baby is half of that criminal. And due to the obvious, something we've known, put aside Darwin or genetics or something like that. We've known this since the ancient world, if not the world of the caveman. The heritability of characteristics. You are like your parents. That child isn't innocent. That child is a rapist on some level. And again, it's kind of tough stuff to say those kinds of things, but we all know that it's true and it's real, and you have to make those decisions. You have to be cruel only to be kind. And I think the responsibility we have, again, to the future should outweigh the responsibility that we have to ourselves, in fact. That's how kind of radical I am about it. I think we have to be willing to say no to people. I don't care if people have a human right to consume whatever they want to. If I were in charge, I would tell them no. I would tell them no to continuing to pollute the environment, to continue to consume at out of control levels, to continue to want it all. At some point, you say no to people. Because we have a responsibility to the future, which I think outweighs our responsibility to ourselves. It certainly outweighs the responsibility, that you have to an embryo of a criminal.
Okay. Well, the problem with that, I would suggest, is that the trouble with law is that, and I'm not a legal scholar by any stretch, but as far as I can understand it, law must restrict the enforcers as well as its subjects. There are some things that we should not allow states to do. As someone who is not authoritarian on pretty much any level, I'm rather libertarian in my politics. I'm not comfortable with states making those kind of intrusive decisions on private lives. I recognize that there is a downside to this because people will make stupid choices and might suffer because of them. However, that is the price that one pays for sort of not even individual freedom, but freedom of families or local communities to commune and to live by their own on their own terms. The idea that the child.
Let me just make this next point, and then feel free to jump in.
Right. Mm-hmm. The idea that the child of a rapist is not innocent because it is a rapist on some level is incredibly dubious, because there isn't actually, as far as I know, any evidence to prove the assertion that the compulsion to commit sexual violence is genetically born, in the sense that, yes, we do have men who go out and do these things. Yes, they have an urge to do it. Yes, they are sexual psychopaths. They don't care about the mental state of their victims. They couldn't give a monkey's about that. But that the idea that you are, you know, programmed to rape from birth is, as far as I know, fanciful. I would love to read any kind of peer-reviewed medical study or genetic study, I should say, that could confirm such a thing, because criminality... Yes, there are bad seeds born in the world. I mean, I used to, you don't know, probably don't know this, Richard, but I used to be a high school teacher. And we used to say informally, never on paperwork, that there were three types of troublesome child. They were mad, bad, and sad, right? They were the ones that had mental illnesses of various kinds, or they were autistic. There was something, they weren't neurotypical. There were the sad ones who were depressed, or they were going through personal trauma or something like that. But you do get bad kids. And I used to teach, I can think of two children off the top of my head who in the modern world would have been diagnosed with ASPD, antisocial personality disorder, which is what they now what they used to call psychopathy. They were genuine teenage psychopaths, and I would swear in front of a jury that that was what they were. They had no conscience, they had no moral code at all. They were very good at following rules, but breaking them when it suited them. So yeah, there are kids that are born wicked. Those children exist, but the idea that every single rapist is genetically programmed to commit sexual violence, I mean, that's spurious. I can't agree with that at all.
Psychopathy
is indeed, but the idea that criminality in general is inheritable is, as far as I'm aware, nonsense. I mean, you know, feel free to educate me. If you've got something that I don't know, feel free to, you know, throw it in.
Well,
if
the personality trait that leads you to do this is highly heritable, then it is what it is. I mean, I don't think we should confuse like the crime itself with the personality type that will commit that crime. It would almost be saying like car theft is heritable, but murder isn't, or something. But both of those are just the actual act. What we're looking at is the personality of the person who does that. And psychopathy combined with low intelligence is a terrifying thing to behold. I don't want my children in an environment that includes those people. Let me go back really quickly to something philosophical, which is that you said, you know, the whole idea of law is that it applies to everyone, more or less, right?
No, the phrase I think I used was law must restrict the enforcers as well as its subjects. So just as the common citizen is not allowed to do things, so should the state not be allowed to do things. And one of the things that I maintain is that, because as I say, I'm not authoritarian on any level, when it comes to the private lives of citizens, the state should keep out. I have no, you know, I don't believe that any national governments should pass laws, say, forbidding, say, for example, you're schizophrenic and you find a lovely lady and, you know, you're settling down and you're taking your medication. You're not a danger. You're more a danger to yourself than anybody else. I don't believe that governments should pass laws forbidding you from breeding with the love of your life, for example. I think that kind of level of intrusion is creepy, if I mean, for want of a better adjective. I dare say you take a different view on this, but no.
Right. Well, I mean, let me think about this, or let's think about this. The person who creates the law fundamentally has to break the law, and you have to break the law in order to create the law. And no, the law does not apply to you. So there is a basic level of hypocrisy. When the United States, you seem to be kind of Americanized a bit in your notion of of, you know, the wonderful of these pure laws that should apply to everyone and no one's above or below them. Again, we Americans had to break the law and actually be traitors to our rightful government in order to say such obvious nonsense. Well, you know, who knows which side I would have taken if I were alive at the time, but yeah, I get it. I'm glad we all get along now. But the law doesn't apply to the government. The government can go to war. The government can arrest you, that is, engage in kidnapping. The government can do all sorts of things that private individuals cannot. A private individual cannot go to war in a way. The government absolutely can. That's one of its most primary basic functions, is the use of violence. So law just simply does not apply to all. You have to take a bigger picture approach of we have enemies in the world. We have to confront the enemies. The enemy doesn't have any rights. You know, your law is only worthwhile so long as you can maintain your territorial integrity and fight off outsiders. So it just doesn't, the law like that, this kind of, you know, beautiful kind of liberal conception only exists within a particular realm. And that realm is always in the shadow of the state. And the state is an instrument of violence and oppression and domination and attack on one's enemies. And I don't say that as some kind of leftist. I think that's it's not even a right wing or a left wing thing. It's just an existential aspect. We have enemies in the world and you have to confront them and maybe destroy them. So the law is not universal. The law only exists within a specific domain, a private sphere. So the law does not apply to the state. There's a basic hypocrisy. So it's nice to say these things, but in the real world, it's just not applicable. And in terms of, if you want to respond to that, you can.
I do.
I'm even more authoritarian.
Seriously. I mean, if I may be bold, Richard, this is a genuine misconception on your part. Laws do indeed apply to the state, provided you can catch them breaking it. Like, for example, police officers, if they're enforcing the law, can arrest someone. You are indeed correct that a citizen in general life can't arrest people. However, we do have something called citizen's arrest in the UK, whereby you could detain someone if they're committing a criminal act, if you've already informed the police that they're doing something wrong. So there was a famous example of a British actor who saw a man mugging a woman who's nicking a handbag and running down the street. And this man sat on the crook. He managed to wrestle the robber to the ground and sat on his back to keep him on the ground, waiting for the police to turn up. So in that context, he was effectively arresting a private citizen, but it was a citizen's arrest. It's a nuance.
We have very similar laws in the United States. It's a completely reasonable thing. Yeah.
But in other words, but also if a policeman arrests a suspect, arrests someone, and in an illegal fashion, because there are laws restricting the act of arrest, those police officers can be prosecuted or disciplined or whatever, you know, depending on the circumstance. So laws do indeed apply to people. Even when you mentioned war. Governments do indeed declare war on people. Sometimes you have to because they're a threat to your, you know, because nation states have the right to defend themselves. But they can't just invade people willy-nilly, at least without criticism. Yes, we're going to mention the Second Gulf War at some point. That's going to happen. But for example, we're drifting away from the pro-life, pro-choice thing. But
ethical questions, yeah.
But the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the reason why Russia is currently under sanction is because it declared war on Ukraine, but without just cause. Therefore, it is an illegal incursion into the sovereign territory of another country. So, the idea that laws don't apply to states is clearly false. It does apply. It applies to everybody. It may apply in different contexts in different ways, but everyone is supposed to be limited by what's scribbled on bits of paper or fired up or kept on the internet now, however they write these laws down. So it's not like private citizens must do what they're told and the state does what it likes. That's not how the world works, as far as I can tell.
Well, you need to distinguish between, say, justifications or ways of legitimizing something and the real world action. The fact is the United States invaded Iraq and the consequences...
Boo hiss.
What?
I said boo hiss. Sorry, I was never a supporter of it.
Yeah, I opposed that war as well. But the consequences it faced were kind of pragmatic ones. It was a completely stupid campaign, ill-conceived. And so it faces consequences. If Russia is going to face sanctions, it is because there is a world community based on states, a world community that's more or less based in post-1944. That is, it was created by the winning powers of the Second World War so that they could enforce their rules on other states, weaker states. That it just is what it is. It's not like God, you know, enacted sanctions on Russia because he broke some moral law. It is basically other states who are in a stronger position sanctioning a state. And as you've yourself admitted, given them themselves the power of the exception, America can, you know, bomb an Iranian general at will and not even consider it an act of war. America can invade Iraq. And basically say, well, it turned out really bad, but you know, we had the best intentions. I mean, come on. We can do that because of history, because we're able to engage in that action. We're a stronger force. So it's not like we're actually beholden to law. We simply use law as a justification for in our quest for power. But anyway, these are other issues. But the major thing is that, I'm not just a brutalist person who thinks you can just, you know, the baby's in your tummy, you're in control, just get rid of it. America, we're badass, you know, what America, fuck yeah, we do whatever we want, who cares? No, like you have to recognize the kind of inherent irrationality to the world, the inherent amorality to existence. Once you're conscious of that, then you can actually start to make decisions based on responsibility. So I actually do want the world to be a better place. I think that conflict, I mean, we're kind of talking geopolitics here, but you know, bear with me. It's interesting. I think conflict is natural and it's always going to be there. But I don't want conflict for conflict's sake or to promote it. I actually think that we can live in a civilized place that you can kind of glimpse in the best of what we see in European society at this point. That is a world that functions, where street level violence is not overwhelming, where we don't have to throw a huge amount of our population in prison. I think we actually can live in a kind of idealistic version of Sweden if we're able to make tough decisions about what kind of population we want on this planet and what kind of world we want to see. So we kind of graduate from that kind of easy morality of individualism and, you know, personal responsibility and all that kind of thing. And we think about collective responsibility on a planetary scale, what we want to see. We want to see a world that's more intelligent and beautiful and more functional and healthy. And we can actually, we have the power to make those decisions. We make all sorts of, the government makes all sorts of terrible, sure, I'll finish up right now. The government makes all sorts of just terrible decisions like invading Iraq or throwing money at cockamamie schemes and all sorts of things. Why can't we use that power? We can kind of advance morally and use that power to building a better world.
Right. Well, this is the thing. I mean, again, you probably don't know this because, again, you've probably watched about four or five of my TikTok videos, but I used to, I'm fairly well traveled. I used to work in the Middle East. I used to work in Australia, New Zealand. I spent a month backpacking in Vietnam randomly, you know, things like this. So I've seen a bit of more of the planet than most of the people of my generation. I've been blessed. I didn't deserve a lot of these opportunities, but I exploited them anyway because, you know, they were there. And it strikes me that the most successful cultures I've ever been to, the cultures that I am most fond of, and again, it's entirely personal and subjective, so you might, I dare say you would object to this, always have some sort of abstract philosophical ideal that they hold above themselves. and that they work towards. They are not naive about the state of the world. They know that nature is anarchic and amoral. They know that governments make pragmatic decisions because you have to. Compromise isn't weakness. Compromise is just being a mature adult and recognizing that you can't get everything you want. The only people who believe that are toddlers and psychopaths. And well, to be honest, toddlers are psychopaths, but that's a different conversation. Now, the point I'm making is that there is always like a higher ideal, and you will always fall short of it. But the point is that you have to aim for it, and you have to aim for it. And the idea, my conception of it, is that it imposes limits on the self, and it imposes limits on the group and all the rest of it. So while, yes, you have to make pragmatic decisions, if you make pragmatic decisions without these principles or values in mind, you can end up down some very dark alleyways, and it ends in disaster. And so I would suggest that, because I believe that all life has innate value, I believe that life begins at conception. I don't, because there's no link, as far as I am concerned, based on what I've read, based on my experience as a teacher, etc. There's no link between intelligence and decency. Some of the nicest people I've ever met were as thick as a whale omelette, and some of the sharpest minds I've ever encountered belong to total bastards. So the idea is, you know, the idea that social responsibility and prosperity and high IQ, that's a very tenuous link. If you have a physical vision of a future where everybody kind of has the same sort of physical facial proportions, where certain diseases are eradicated on a genetic level, if you think you can achieve that, then yeah, okay, that's what you would aspire to. I don't believe in that. I just want to live in a world, my ideal future is one where, despite physical or mental disabilities, despite one's ugliness or lack of beauty, however you want to phrase it, that there's a kindness and a compassion, and that everybody sort of gets along together. Because yeah, you mentioned Sweden, an ideal version of Sweden. Sweden isn't exterminating people with mental illnesses. Sweden isn't exterminating its criminal population or breeding out the criminal element from its population. They have made adjustments, of course. They do have a prison system and all the rest of it. And yes, Sweden is a successful country, but not because they've taken this sort of radical eugenicist route. I mean, I you want to come back on this, I know, so I mean, feel free to respond.
Sweden is eliminating 80 to 90% of fetuses with Down syndrome. I mean, that's just an example of the degree to which they actually are taking these measures. So is the United States, all the way to a lesser degree due to our kind of religious fanaticism upbringing, you could say.
Right.
Early years.
But this is,
are these
which,
things
which leads to,
aren't these things kind of connected on several on some level? Like however attenuated they are, the eugenics programs that do exist in these countries, and then just custom, if you want to use that term, that is eugenic. These things still exist in the world, and they still can have a positive effect. And it seems like as we degenerate as a society, we seem to be kind of getting away from those things that really made us who we are. We're not crazed cavemen. We're not, you know, out of control, violent, vulgar people from thousands of years ago. We actually did kind of bring ourselves up to a higher level of humanity through will on some level. And why we want to get rid of that type of inheritance is beyond me. I think the possibilities of what we can do with the human population going forward are just tremendous and immense. The possibilities of what we can do with technology if we, again, stand outside of it and attempt a conscious evolution of technology is, again, tremendous and would fill every person with hope. And yet, again, we want to just go back towards notions of either kind of individual rights or human rights or something like that. Or I would say, you know, if I if there's some kind of philosophy out there that's rather dark and so on, it is this just degenerating egalitarian vision that I see from pro-lifers and Catholics in particular, of this notion that, you know, oh, that every all lives matter, or, you know, every human being, some, you know, wonderful thing. And that, you know, the children of rapists need to be born, the more children, the merrier. We need to fill up the entire planet with a bunch of totally incompetent human beings who, you know, want to have it all and consume well beyond their limits. And, you know, even the most vile murderer, rapist kind of has value at some level. I mean, I find some people find that it's tantalizing in a kind of sentimental fashion. But the ultimate world that these Christians are promoting is not just dissociated from reality, but I think is actually extremely dark and terrifying. I think most people who are good people, that is, they have a sense of ethics and morality. They want a different world than that. They don't want to overpopulate the planet and destroy the environment and allow, you know, every criminal to breed at random, to allow every like moron to knock up some chick in Texas, and then you know, got her on the hook. Now we, you know, now she's going to have all my children. No one wants that kind of world. Real sensible people who have intellect, who have a sense of morality, they don't want that kind of world. So, you know, I don't know. I think the pro-life movement, the vision of the future that it has, strikes me as just extremely hopeless and dark, and without any even understanding of responsibility. Do we really, I mean, you know, populations decline pretty naturally due to modernization, but I mean, do we really want to just overrun the natural world with human beings? I mean, can we at least take seriously the fact that there is a carrying capacity to this planet? And beyond that, that there's a value in the natural world, a value that should actually surpass just mere human life. That is, that the natural world itself is beautiful, itself is worthy of protection, that we want wide open spaces and beauty, that is more important than saving every possible human life on the planet, knowing that so many of these people are going to be just surplus consumers. You know, we need to have I actually think humanity needs a before we can make positive decisions involving technology and politics and society, there really does have to be a moral revolution that we undergo. And this current individualist morality is leading us someplace very dark.
Okay. Right. Okay. Well, I'm trying to rewind the tape and play it back at half speed to make sure I've got all your points, right? So if I miss anything, that is entirely my fault, but let's go back to the beginning. You talk about the fact that Sweden is wiping out its Down syndrome population. This is also true in the UK, and I'm guessing it's true in the United States. In fact, it was because I was part of my teacher training. I went to a special educational needs school, what you would call a special needs school, like the kids who ride the short bus, those people. Right. And I went to a special school for those children. And these are children with like low functioning autism, all sorts of horrible things. And the deputy head teacher was taking me on a tour of the building. And he said to me, you know, this is talking about the nature of the cohort in the school. And he said, of course, we don't get many kids with Down syndrome anymore. And I went, oh, okay. Why is that then? And he goes, well, there are two reasons. One, mainstream schools are better at integrating Down syndrome kids. And I thought, oh, okay, that's fine. And the second is that the parents just abort them.
Yeah.
And this answer haunted me. This answer that just abort them, just get rid of them, haunted me. And that, to be honest, was the trigger event for my sort of like pro-life position. Getting rid of Down syndrome children, to use that as an example, doesn't actually make your culture more socially responsible, doesn't reduce the rate of criminality, doesn't actually do anything constructive other than means you don't have to spend any resources on their education and healthcare, for example. That's what you save. But in terms of, you know, social cohesion and things like that, it doesn't really do much. Let's jump forward. I've forgotten what the middle bit was, which is not helpful. But the last bit you mentioned was about the natural world. You said you don't want to create a future of just, infinite morons consuming irresponsibly. You want these wide open spaces and things like that. So do I. I would like that. That seems great. The problem with the idea of overpopulation, which is there's an anti-natalist quality to the environmental movement, which I find really disturbing. But the idea of overpopulation is kind of misframed, because overpopulation isn't a general like planetary problem. Overpopulation is only a problem in population centers. So, for example, you could argue that London is overpopulated, New York is overpopulated, Los Angeles is definitely overpopulated. It's incapable of sustaining human life. It wasn't designed to. It's just massive highways and skyscrapers, as far as I can figure out. So overpopulation is a problem where population is concentrated, because resources are diverted and there's all sorts of, like, you know, human effluent in the water supply, and the farm culture is a nightmare. Industrial farming is a horror. One of the reasons I became a vegetarian is because I object to factory farming. I think it's a disaster for the planet. Again, we're moving away from the abortion topic, but there's this idea. So we are irresponsible consumers, and I do believe that we should live more responsibly and equally. Is that the right adverb? Can't remember. We should live in harmony with the natural world around us more than we do, because we effectively as a species rape the planet and drain it dry of any natural resources. So yeah, I mean, this is perfectly reasonable. I support the use of avoiding fossil fuels, for example, because I know that 50, 60 years down the line, we're going to turn this entire rock into a smoggy dump. It's going to happen at some point. But again, I don't see, I mean, for example, you could change zoning laws and allow people to move out of the cities. You can change the way people consume food. You can incentivize companies to recycle or to use natural resources more responsibly. There are all sorts of things you can do to preserve the natural environment that have nothing to do with killing unborn children. And that's my ultimate argument, I think, when it comes to this topic, is because I don't believe in the genetic perfection of humanity. I don't see that as my, that's not my, I don't, I'm not a utopian. I don't have those kind of visions. Abortion on demand to me seems unnecessary when there are so many other things that we as, I mean, you're obviously an American, I'm British. There are so many other things we could do as national cultures, as nation states, maybe working in collaboration with each other, that have nothing to do with policing, you know, genetic lines, that have nothing to do with exterminating unborn life, that have nothing to do with perfecting the human species, because I don't believe that human beings are fundamentally perfectible. There is no ideal human being that one will achieve. It doesn't exist. It's entirely a mental construct. So yeah, by all means, be responsible with the environment, et cetera, et cetera. Still doesn't justify abortion on demand. That would be my final argument or final line on that.
Okay, let me focus on, I mean, I you're of course correct when you're talking about, you know, a city like Los Angeles being a kind of hellscape that can't sustain human life. I mean, that's overstated, perhaps, but I get your point.
So I wonder they're shooting each other.
But it's not just a matter of urban centers, although I of course don't deny those problems. It really is a matter of population. There is a plastic heap the size of Australia in the ocean right now due to the consumption, not just in Los Angeles, but across the planet. The notion of all people on the world in the world living in an American or British lifestyle in terms of consumption is just radically unsustainable. We don't have anywhere approaching the kind of resources to sustain that.
I agree.
And well, you know, how are we going to deal with that reality outside of planning the population on some level. I mean, it's because I think this whole kind of like natalism thing really needs to be, taken seriously. So one interesting thing about abortions over the past 30 years is, at least in the United States, and I can't quite speak for all their countries, but I imagine they fit the same trend, is that abortions are actually declining. And sex is, in fact, declining pretty tremendously. Millennials and Gen Z are having a lot less sex than my Gen X generation did at their age, than the boomers did at their age, even the traditionalist or silent generation did at their age. So there are actually really terrible things happening. And I guess I wouldn't fully blame the platform that you've achieved success on, but TikTok, you can blame lots of things, but I do think that social media and TikTok have not helped, let's say, in people touching grass, as they say, or looking at someone in their eyes and not just tweeting at them or texting them or something like that. I think there are a lot of factors at play that have kind of disconnected us from human connection and the natural world. So we're going through a fertility crisis. Sex itself is actually declining. People have all sorts of sexual identities. They're not actually engaging in sex. It's a remarkable contradiction. Now, fertility generally declines when women are modernized to some degree, when child mortality goes down due to medical advances, when they have a chance to get educated or at least get literate, maybe have a career of some kind, when they're kind of pulled out of just the village and the tribe, and they're exposed to the natural world to some degree. So we are going to go through a population decline, whether we like it or not. And one remarkable thing is that fertility is actually declining even faster in the third world as they are being modernized than it declined in, say, the United States across the 19th and 20th century. So populations are collapsing in this way. And I think there are a whole host of causes for this, but there are these natalist movements that want to just kind of protect the world as it is. You know, oh, we need the welfare state can't be sustained, or I think Elon Musk is in these Silicon Valley con artists. I mean, Elon Musk is probably the biggest fraud on the planet, but all of these con artists in Silicon Valley, they just want more bodies to tweet more, basically. Or to, you know, we need more users. We need a user base. So just pump out, you know, we need to expand this horrifying postmodern hell around the planet so we can find more users. And we need the current people in this prison to have more babies so that we can, you know, create the social network of the 22nd century. That they want to maintain the world as it is. And so their response to the lack of the fertility crisis, if you want to call it that, depopulation that will be headed, we will be experiencing in the 21st century, is just stop it, do something, and make abortion, outlaw abortion. Let's start, you know, encouraging people to have more children. Let's just keep doing what we're doing. What we're doing is the problem. And I think we might actually agree on this. I think we need a fundamental reorientation of the world, and we need to recognize really serious mistakes that we made in the 20th century. But depopulation is, whether it's coming from just modernization itself or whether there's an almost instinct, a kind of nihilistic urge among the world population to not have children. Whatever it is, this is happening. And this will kind of give us a chance to solve a lot of these problems, to not make the same mistake twice, to not create the kind of increasing hellscape that we've created now. So I don't think depopulation of the planet, it's happening whether we like it or not. We reached 8 billion people the other day on the planet. We're going to be headed back towards 7 and 6 and 5 pretty shortly due to demographic pyramids in the first world and in the third world. And we need to, that is not a problem in itself. And I think it's actually going to give us a kind of second chance to build a technological society, but one that is in some ways pro-human, that we're not going to be kind of descending into this nihilistic void that we descended before. I'm sorry, I'm kind of speechifying here and I'm saying these big concepts. I've kind of moved.
That's my tendency.
I like to have a good, you know, good discussion.
No, absolutely. I'm happy to respond to the points you've made.
I'll give you a chance for and then we'll go into the Q&A pretty quick.
Well, Richard is indeed correct in the sense that consumer capitalism has basically consumed or absorbed all of our lives. Consumer capitalism, admittedly, was an American invention, but I won't hold Richard to blame for that. It wasn't his idea. But the idea of just mindless consumption, mindless purchasing, the idea of like things like fast fashion, you know, the idea that you've got these mills in Central Asia pumping out cheap clothes that people wear twice and throw away. This is the unsustainable thing we're talking about. So there is an environmental drain. And in many respects, the population boom that has occurred since the Second World War is a product of consumer capitalist society, because, of course, as people were able to earn more money, buy bigger houses, buy more stuff to sustain larger families, they were able to breed more and therefore have larger. So maybe the population decline is just an inevitable fact of being, you know, part of the animal cycle of being a human being on this planet, because consumer capitalism isn't sustainable. And you'll find people from all political fields. I'm a member of the British Conservative Party. Liberals agree. The Green Party agrees. Left or right, it's not even a partisan issue anymore. It's a recognition that the current economic model, the way our cultures and our economies run, isn't sustainable. It's going to die, and then we're just going to have to manage the downfall. Mindless growth is not going to happen, because again, inevitably you're going to run out of stuff to make and people to buy the stuff. And you might have heard that in Britain we're going through a cost of living crisis. Well, you know, bills are shooting up. People are deciding which meals they eat in a day, and that's actually quite alarmingly common. It's like a couple of million people who are in this camp. So yeah, everything is going to decline like that. So yeah, populations may well decline. The idea though that we should seize the opportunity to police the genome, the wider human genome, I can't support realistically, because again, I don't think it's going to work. I don't believe in the genetic, as we've already established, I don't believe in the genetic origin of certain antisocial behaviors. I don't think that you can, you know, just because someone is physically beautiful, they might be ugly on the inside. I'm one of those people. Maybe it is sentimental. You've used that word before.
That's impossible.
But yeah. What's that? Sorry.
Okay. That's impossible. That never happens. Okay. Do you think that athleticism is a heritable trait? Do you think that if you tried to be the greatest Olympic diver, you watch the Olympics as a kid and you're like, I'm going to do that. I'm going to be a diver. Even if you just dedicated your life, you woke up at 5 a.m., practiced diving, you eat, slept, diving your entire youth. Do you think you could be an Olympic diver?
Well, I don't know.
I'm not trying to insult you here, but I'm asking a rhetorical question.
No, I don't. I mean, I honestly don't know. I mean, being an Olympic diver, I've got a pretty high lung capacity. I was never good at sport at school, to be fair. But I mean, I don't know, because it's one of those impossible questions. You know, if I could fantasize.
Do you think I really wanted to beat Usain Bolt at sprinting and I just was passionate and had a really great work ethic, do you think I could ever do that?
I've seen you on stage and I've seen your physique. You don't strike me as lithe or lightweight enough to be a sprinter at any level. So no, I'm going to say no. I don't think you could beat Usain Bolt in a race.
All right, I've got a good physique, but go on.
But you don't have a sprinter's body.
My type is very different. Okay, so what we're saying is something like athleticism, it doesn't matter how great your work ethic is. It is something that you inherit. It's just, there's something, whether it's balance or the inner ear or muscle firing or just your the kind of lottery that you won at birth of the weight distribution between muscles and bone and fat and so on. It's just something that you inherited. It is purely genetic. So, you know, athletes whose parents are athletes. I mean, it's just, how can you deny the power of inheritance? If something is as like athleticism, why would that not apply to intelligence or criminal personality or all sorts of things?
Well, I mean, the only thing I would say is that, yes, there might be a genetic component to certain attributes of the human animal. Yes, if your parents are athletic, they have certain genes that you could pass on to your children. That's undoubtedly true. But you also have to have the resources, the time, especially the money these days, let's be honest, to make use of that natural talent and to refine it. There's also the possibility that once you've refined the talent, that you never beat your parents' record. I mean, the idea that you're the offspring of your children, the offspring of a great parent would be greater than the parent if they breed properly is not necessarily true. I used to know a young lady my age. I mean, she must be my age now. We've fallen out of contact. But her father was a professor of physics and her mother was a professor of mathematics. They were both taught at university, fiercely intelligent people. And with the best will in the world, she was thick. I mean, she was a nice girl. She was a lovely lady. You know, she wasn't a criminal coward by any stretch. Sure. But she wasn't of. Well, in fact, no, I don't think thick is fair. I just think she was of average intelligence. She just didn't have her parents' brilliance. So the idea that you could select breeding pairs and perfect, you know, develop human intelligence in that way, or human athleticism, to use the earlier example, it's not predictable. It doesn't quite work like that. Maybe if it were that predictable, there'd be a stronger argument, but I just can't see it. It's not.
Well, I'm not saying it's 100% by any chance, by any stretch. And there are plenty of examples of, you know, poor kind of downtrodden parents, and they just throw out a genius. You know, how could it happen? Yeah. And it is a kind of random, you know, collection or constellation of different genes, and it is kind of luck. I'm by no means saying that we can, you know, this is not some like Gattaca or kind of sci-fi thing that you can just like.
That is the image I had in my head. Was that film Gattaca?
Person and so on. No, we're not even anywhere close to genetic engineering on that level. But since the beginning of time, certainly since the ancient world, we have absolutely had conceptions of bloodline and inheritance. And it's by no means 100%. Maybe it's not even 50%, but it is powerful. And, I imagine that the daughter of the two professors, she might have been average. She's probably not thick to be. She probably was not mentally retarded. And she's not a criminal. She's an average person, kind of like the rest of us. But the notion that inheritance doesn't play a factor in the generating of offspring, I don't know how that is tenable. We like to say these things, and that's interesting. You mentioned you're a member of the Conservative Party and so on. You hear a lot of this on the left of, you know, race is skin deep or something like that. They think it's just some kind of random skin color. As if, you know, a race doesn't have much more to do. Skin color is just a kind of minor aspect of this. Race has to do with body size and the brain. All right, excuse me. I'm getting some yes, guys. Really, how was it? Okay. I'm getting reports on Harry Potter. Fascinating good. Stuff.
Good.
It might be yes. a good time.
We'll be done in 15 minutes.
This might be a good time. We'll jump into the Q&A. Want to say, folks, our guests are linked in the description. If you would like to hear more from our guests, you certainly can. And that includes that the podcast, every debate from Modern Day Debate is uploaded to the podcast with our guest links in the description box there too, in case you'd like to learn more about their views. This first question coming in from, do appreciate it, Alex Jones. I don't think it's that Alex Jones. Says does
no, I shouldn't think so. He's busy right now, I should think.
He's got his hands full. But he said, they asked, does Richard Spencer believe that Bumble, let's see, That Bumble is a good way to find a life partner. I'm not sure if this is something to do with the eugenics of dating or something else.
Yes, this is. I heard this story. Apparently, someone has found a Bumble profile for Richard Spencer. Whether it's actually you, Richard, I don't know. Is it you? Were you on Bumble for a time?
Yes, I confirmed it. In fact, I don't lie. Sorry. We're kind of having a break. Oh, there. We're back. Okay, we had a break.
Yeah, I'm there. Yeah.
No, I created a profile and didn't lead to anything actually, but I remember I was actually traveling, and I was traveling to Texas for some things, and so someone met me there, and then I don't even know the exact story. I didn't read the article, but I did confirm it to the journalist. I mean, I don't care. I did nothing wrong, but I do think that it did strike me as kind of rather fascinating, because the journalist was a kind of gatekeeper of, let's keep Richard Spencer off Bumble. And it was almost a kind of reproductive policing going on, you know, like, uh-oh, that guy might be, passing on his genes through this app. We need to do every measure to make sure that horrifying individuals like Richard Spencer aren't allowed in the world.
Well, yeah, I was on Bumble for about 2 or 3 months, and it was also a disaster. So I'm not, I'm not a big fan of the platform. Anyway, that's a bit
it's
of a
not
it,
the only way. I think it leads to non-reproductive sex, is my impression. All of these dating apps, it leads to a one night stand. I can't imagine.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest. But there we go. Okay, yeah. Well, that was a bit of a side quest. Moving on.
Jumping in.
They're trying to troll me, and I say, hey, I'm not a liar. I'll admit my faults.
This is made by Jim Bob. I think they say Richard isn't a woman taking responsibility for her actions at a bar, an expression of a better society.
Well, is this a deception? A woman just gets knocked up because she's drunk and meets some dude at a bar?
That might be what you're getting at. That's all it said for the question.
Is that what it's talking about? Well, I think under sober reflection, we can make better decisions. But I would say this. I do think that there's a lot of bashing of females, you know, on the right. But I would say that women really are the most eugenic creatures. Women make you fight to reproduce. Women don't believe in, 50-50 universal mandatory wife or GF or something like that. Women really are the bottleneck fundamentally. And I think that's a very positive thing. This is a grotesque example, but I really love it. I was watching a David Attenborough documentary actually with my kids. I love David Attenborough. I think he's an amazing guy. He articulates things differently, but basically agrees with what I've said previously. But it was these bees, and there was this it was the mating of bees in Africa, and it was the most kind of grotesque example of the bottleneck that exist in the population, and that is ultimately eugenic and positive. So there'd be a big field of bees, and the female bees would kind of present themselves for mating. And all of the males would descend on these bees, and they would engage in this brutal death orgy where the male bees are fighting against one another and tearing off limbs and wings and so on. And just a few male bees, maybe like 2-5%, actually get to mate. But even while they're mating, they're getting torn apart by the men. And it's this amazing crucible, this just struggle for the future. And only the strong survive. And it makes sure that this is the greatest bee population possible, the struggle. And the females obviously are participating in that. They only want the top 1%. And so the female sex really is, they are inherently eugenic. They're going to make you fight for it. They're going to go after men who are tall, muscular, intelligent, cool. Sometimes they make bad decisions and they go after someone who's badass, like the the dude who's probably a psychopath with a leather jacket who has a motorcycle and so on. You know, nobody's perfect, but they are really the eugenic sex. It's really men who either want to just spread their seed far and wide, you know, kind of a natural tendency we have, or the kind of resentful men who want to, you know, mandatory monogamy or something like that. But it's actually the females who are most eugenic.
We'll jump into the next one.
Can I respond to that, James? Is that all right?
Super short and pithy, because we spent a lot of time on this one.
Okay.
Yeah, no, sure. Okay, so the idea of survival of the fittest, Charles Darwin, while he was examining the natural world, never intended his philosophy or his evolutionary theory to be applied to human society. Social Darwinism is something that was taken and built based on his work. Even Richard Dawkins, who's often called Darwin's Rottweiler, it freely admits that while Darwinian, the origin of species by means of natural selection is how the natural world operates, it doesn't mean that it should be applied to human society. There is a division there. Again, that's just a random rebuttal there. James wants to move on.
I could go on for a minute, but Dawkins is a coward, even though I kind of like it.
This one from Yehuda Finkelstein says, what is Richard Spencer's TikTok handle?
I am only following one person. I'm opening TikTok here.
Both of our guests are linked in the show notes. Want to remind you.
Richard Spencer _.
And this one coming in from, made by Jim Bob, says, intelligent societies can be evil, though, Richard.
Mm-hmm. This is that from, a criticism?
Yeah, this is one of the things that intelligence is not only is intelligence not a survival trait, because most species on the planet are not clever. They don't create the high art. They're not capable of highly complex abstract thought. But yet it is possible for intelligent people to be antisocial or just downright wicked by some moral code. That's why selecting for intelligence, well, you know, intelligence has its advantages. It's not the only characteristic that one needs to consider if one is thinking about creating an ideal society. That would be my argument.
Okay.
This one coming in from Go Away says, intelligence is not beneficial for humans. High IQ is detrimental to reproduction. Your preference for it is irrelevant. We will never get smarter. S-O-Z. What does that mean?
Soz. Sorry. I think it's sorry in tech speak.
Gotcha. Thank you.
You broke up real quickly. We'll never become more. What is he saying?
I think they might be saying, like, if we select for intelligence, they say intelligence is not beneficial for humans. High IQ is actually instead detrimental to reproduction. Your preference for it is irrelevant. We will never get smarter. So I think they're saying that even if we do select for intelligence, that society will decline in the sense that there will be less reproduction, which is, I think they're saying that's a bad thing, that there's less.
That's true in a way now. I mean, you know, there is an inverse relation, more or less major exceptions, between IQ and fertility. That was not at all the case previously in our history. The higher classes, more intelligent people were absolutely outbreeding the lower classes. This kind of big change occurred with the 19th century and industrial revolution.
You got it.
Be actually proven pretty definitively, but go ahead.
And this one from Mike says, Richard, wouldn't laws against abortion shape the behaviors of people? Namely, wouldn't they be less likely to get abortions? I think there's, and maybe they're also saying by extension, maybe be less likely to be promiscuous.
Right. Yeah. There are a lot of interesting things in there. I mean, obviously, if contraception's available, if abortion's available, that's going to incentivize being promiscuous. I get it. It's very interesting that, you know, that's not exactly happening. Sex at a rather depressing rate. And so I think it actually is a lot more complicated than that. But keep in mind, if you're going, you can't have it both ways. The same laws that are going to supposedly inspire a more responsible Christian society are also going to benefit people who break those rules, that is the rapist and criminal types. And you're going to have to say to the face of a teenage girl who was raped, you're going to have this child. So there's kind of both sides. I think it's more complicated than that, even though I admit your basic logic seems sound, but it's obviously more complicated than that.
This one from Mars. I think this is for you, Kendon. First one says, how do you support the claim that life is sacred?
I don't think I've ever used that phrase, life is sacred. I'm not, believe it or not, and this might surprise Richard, I'm not a religious person. I'm not a believer. I don't believe in God or the soul or anything like that. I would like there to be one. Well,
I believe I'm a Christian.
Yeah, I suppose I'm a Christian atheist. If such a creature exists, if you can bear the contradiction. I was raised, my mother tried to raise us Methodist, it didn't take. Obviously, we have prayer in school, unlike in the United States. I read a lot of religious philosophy, theology. I have internalized a lot of these arguments, but I appreciate them as a secular, I hope I'm a secular thinker, but as somebody, I can see there's some merit in a lot of these arguments, even if the metaphysical underpinnings don't ring true for me. So again, that might be a flaw in my logic, but yeah, I don't think life being sacred, I just think it's wise to hold life to a higher value. That's all. And if there are inconsistencies in my arguments, then I would welcome people to bring those out, and then I'd have to be forced to confront them. But yeah, life is sacred. No, because I'm not a religious person. I wouldn't use that phrase.
You got it. 2 seconds. I've got a frozen screen here, and it's about to clear up. But I want to say, folks, our guests are linked in the description. In the meantime, while I wait to get to this next question, as I've got a frozen screen here, you can find their links at the podcast as well. If you're listening to this debate there, we put every guest links in the description box there too. This one coming in from Yehuda Finkelstein says, Richard Lauren, let me know if I pronounce this right. It's the Colorado, I think she's a House rep. Lauren Boebert, is it Boebert? Is the
Lauren Boebert, but it's kind of funny to say.
They say is the unacknowledged daughter of the 80s pro wrestler Stan Lane. I checked Wikipedia. That's a little bit is alleged. They say, is Boebert the type of person that made you pro-choice?
Yeah, kind of. I'm sorry, you broke up there for a moment. She's the unacknowledged daughter of whom?
The 80s pro wrestler Stan Lane. I'm a huge pro wrestling fan. I haven't heard of them, so I don't think they're like that big, but they are a Wikipedia page. And allegedly, she is his unacknowledged daughter, although a paternity test also found that there didn't seem to be evidence for that. But nonetheless, they say, granting it, is Boebert the type of person that made you pro-choice?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I don't want to make it too personal. But yeah, I think it's kind of, I've suggested this with my, on my, podcast or video podcast with Ed Dudden. I think there's a kind of unconscious will to survival among people like Boebert that they kind of recognize on some secret level that they're the types who would be eliminated. And so they're kind of pursuing their own strategy by being pro-life. Kind of, everyone gets in, the club or something. I know that sounds kind of extremely mean to say, but.
Gotcha. And then this one coming in from Incapacitating Strike says, I'm glad Richard has the quote moral courage to state that he's willing to achieve his political goals on abortion. They say a mountain of dead children. So more of a statement than a question. If you want to respond, Richard, we'll give you a chance.
No.
You got it. Go away, right. Says Downs people, I think they mean Down syndrome people, don't reproduce genes for Downs syndrome. Downs syndrome are carried through non-Down syndrome people. Aborting them means their parents have more reproductive kids with bad genes.
Okay. Interesting.
Well, because Down syndrome is a random mutation. It's something that occurs naturally and entirely randomly. It's not like, I come from a long line of people with Down syndrome. That's not how it works. So one could argue that it's almost impossible to predict in advance whether a child would have Down. It's incredibly rare, as a genetic mutation, but it's impossible to predict in advance whether your child, your first child, for example, would have it, You just have to sort of lump them and they do the scans or they test the amniotic fluid, you know.
But when they're here, they are a major burden to society and kind of a burden to themselves in that sense. But the questioner is absolutely correct when he says.
This one from Chess119 says, are you debating abortion or eugenics? It seems like Richard is using it to argue for eugenics. Or if I understand right, would it be fair to say, Richard, that you're making a case for the pro-choice side? You could say an indirect kind of argument, but nonetheless, an argument for...
Yes, so abortion is just a component of a larger eugenic vision, yes.
I see. And then K-Max McDonald says, when China reached over 1 billion people, they had their solution to this. I take it Richard and Kendon would differ on how to deal with this problem. How does a country address overpopulation?
You can take that first.
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously, I shouldn't slag off China because I'm famous on TikTok, which is the worst kind of famous. And TikTok is, of course, a Chinese app. And I believe all the conspiracy theories about TikTok, incidentally. It is a Chinese spyware and all that. I do believe this fundamentally. However, the idea that, you know, the Chinese response to its problem of overpopulation was brutal, dictatorial, authoritarian. The idea that China is a model state in any capacity is horrifying. You know, the social credit system, the constant surveillance, the lack of privacy, and things like that. Yes, there were over a billion people in China, but the downside of their one-child policy, because again, it's now expanded to two children, I believe. They've actually repealed the one-child policy. You can now have two kids. Is the case of gendercide, because what they've done is they've left, if you accidentally fall pregnant, you can go to the government for an abortion. But because the Chinese culture is fiercely patriarchal, having a daughter is expensive because you've got to pay for the dowry, for the wedding and things like that. So they're now actually suffering, they might actually suffer a population crisis because their abortion policy has wiped out too many baby girls. So it's not a credible solution to the problem. Even if you want to manage the population on that level, yeah, the Chinese response has ultimately failed to some degree. If Richard wants to get on that, I don't know.
What is the solution to overpopulation?
Correct.
I do. It's a complicated question because every population on the planet, to a lesser degree, sub-Saharan Africa, but more or less every population on the planet is undergoing a fertility decline. And as I mentioned earlier, the third world is actually going through that fertility decline at a faster rate than did the United States, for example, during its history. So modernity is hitting them hard and it's hitting them fast. So we will be undergoing a population reduction worldwide due to a whole host of factors, abortion being one, contraception being much more important than abortion. And as well, just the horrors of modernity of, you know, living in your home, you know, masturbating to a TikTok video as opposed to meeting a human being. Those are also profoundly important. So I do think that the overpopulation crisis is kind of correcting itself. I think the bigger question is kind of like, how are we going to deal with this? And how are we going to think about it and understand it? Are we going to, you know, fanatically try to reverse it or try to maintain the current trajectory that we're on? Or are we going to kind of use that as an opportunity to go on a very different path?
You got it. There's one coming in from, do appreciate it. Chess119 says, Richard, you can clarify if you'd like in terms of whether, because this wasn't explicitly stated in the debate, but we'll give you a chance whether or not they're correct. They say, would you support eugenics if it was an Anglo-Saxon Protestants who are prohibited from procreation? If not, then why is it just for other groups?
Eugenics really isn't a matter of race, although I guess that is a component to it to some extent, but it's not the primary component to it. Eugenics would involve all people. All people could be bettered through eugenics. And I guess you could say it's maybe more of a class issue than a race issue. There would be no real eugenics program that anyone would support or want that would say, let's kill all WASP or something like that. It would be more about all populations, breeding towards higher types, but also kind of recognizing the fact that society is multi-layered, and there's certainly a need for people to do work that is less cognitively demanding. But it's not just a matter of like eliminating a group. I mean, that is a genocide, what that person is describing. That is not what I am advocating for. Eugenics is a very different concept than genocide. Although granted, ever since the 1930s, but certainly ever since the Second World War, those two things have kind of been muddled together.
You got this one from Plummy. 0005 says, Richard, is your ideal world the society in, quote, a brave new world, unquote?
No, I think the brave new world is a society that we're living in now. A brave new world is very different than, say, 1984. I remember having this conversation when I was about 19 in college. And I said, I don't fear 1984. I fear a brave new world. A brave new world is a vision of society where we are heavily using narcotics, and we're using almost sex, sex becomes almost masturbation in that sense. You go to the feelies and you kind of get off. I think that's what we are. That's where we are now. People are sitting in front of their computers, watching high definition, hardcore pornography and masturbating and having a sexual experience that is in fact more intense and in a horrible way, more satisfying than, you know, having a girlfriend and engaging in kind of the awkward all elbows lovemaking that is the reality in this world. We all know it's kind of true. It can be awkward, but when they experience this hyper reality on the internet, it's never awkward. It's always this wildly intense experience. So I think we are living in a kind of brave new world society, and we need to revolt against it and go down a completely different path.
You got it. This one from Hake says, John R. Lott Jr. showed out of wedlock births went up after Roe.
That might very well be true. I don't fully trust that scholar. He's made some very incorrect claims on gun control, but that very well might be true. But whether the Roe decision caused that is also questionable. I mean, divorce is actually declining at the current at the moment because people are getting married less often. Sex is declining. Abortion is declining. This is another kind of odd thing about the current state of affairs. So you need to, there are a lot of things that can be correlated, but aren't necessarily caused. I do probably think, to be fair, that there probably is a causal element to abortion. Abortion kind of incentivized from promiscuity. But again, the weird thing about the current world is that that's not happening. People are less promiscuous as a whole. They're having less sex. They're getting married less often. They're having less abortions.
You got it. This one from
Bizarre.
Made by Jim Bob says, Richard, do you know how to pump your septic tank? They in chat tried to explain, I think that they're saying that people such as like plumbers aren't desired in your kind of ideal world. And I think this is a way of kind of giving pushback.
I didn't say that. And I actually did mention, perhaps I should have put more emphasis on it. I don't want to breed a population of highly neurotic philosophy majors. I think if we ever had such a society, everyone would be hanging out at a coffee shop discussing Heidegger and no one would be pumping the septic tank. I basically agree with that. I think society does need to have multi layers. That being said, there is no good reason to breed for lower intelligence or to breed for proneness towards obesity or to breed for heart disease, to maintain genetic illnesses in the population. There's no good reason to do that, but there are good reasons to keep, you know, the society's multi-layered, and they're going to be plumbers and they're going to be philosophy students. That's good.
You got it. And That looks to be it. So I want to say, folks, oh, wait, hold on. Maybe there's like kind of a last little burst of questions. This one from Hunter P says, criminality and abortion are directly correlated. Statistically, states that criminalize abortion will have a higher rate of crime. We've known this.
Yeah, that's usually because the people who tend to have abortions tend to live in low-income areas, poor areas, work, you know, and therefore people turn to crime. It's usually petty crime. You'll find that the areas where abortion is difficult or illegal, the crimes you're talking about, it's not like mass murder, it's not gang rape, it's, you know, car thief, it's carjacking, it's, you know, robbing old ladies of their handbags. Still unacceptable, but it's petty theft. It's petty crimes rather than, well, I don't know, is carjacking a petty crime? I don't know. But yeah, it's a very low level. If you could address the material needs, a lot of these people wouldn't be breaking the law. You're never going to eradicate crime from an anti-abortion area. I mean, that's not what I'm arguing. But yes, the idea that these areas are riddled with criminals purely because the crime gene is allowed to spread through the population, I don't buy it.
You got it. This is Karatikos Eustace says, has Richard seen The Bit by academic agent called Maddow or Spencer?
Yes. I'm not sure I've seen the whole thing. I've seen The Bit. I think that's a real misunderstanding of me. It's looking at, you know, basic, you know, I voted for Joe Biden, you know, whatever. And it's kind of like, oh, is this Spencer matter? Or I think J6 was a horrible thing and, you know, whatever. It's looking at kind of superficial issues and seeing that I align with Maddow. It's, you know, kind of funny, but I think very shallow. It also comes from our kind of politicized or polarized environment where people are so terrified of thinking that like the left might be right about something. You know, it's like, and it goes down to kind of like unique or really, it goes down to a really small granular level of like, do you like a movie that Rachel Maddow liked or something? It's just kind of bizarre. I think you can actually be an open-minded, thoughtful person and learn things from the left and from leftist thinkers.
You guys.
And yeah. Okay. Sorry.
This one,
I always ramble.
No worries. Hunter P asks or says, criminality and abortions are directly got that one. Plummy 005 says, the idea that birth rate is completely correlated with intelligence is only half true. The birth rate is above replacement level for those making below $30,000 a year and those above $250,000 a year as well.
Yes. Now, obviously, the people making more than $250,000 a year is a much smaller population, but that is true. I say this to Ed a lot, and he'll, you know, oh, the data doesn't, yes, but I totally agree. Also, one thing that he's, that Ed Dudden has looked into is that if you're highly intelligent, but you have a certain kind of religious instinct or kind of right-wing instinct, you are more likely to have children. So it really is kind of left-wing liberalism plus high IQ and education that is just this sterilization factory. But yeah, it is more complicated. But yeah, it's interesting, a kind of high-low question where people who are doing really well are breeding at replacement levels. And then people who, you know, can barely come up with $10 to buy a hamburger are also breeding it at high levels. It's interesting.
You got it. This one coming in from Urbanite says, question for both. When we bury family members' bodies, are they still human despite no longer being conscious?
Yeah. They're human. I mean, they're dead human beings, but they're still human beings. They don't turn into ligimas or orangutans or lampposts. They're still human. They're still just human corpses. I think
Being alive or dead is kind of the operative quality to them, not
yeah. The fact that they no longer suck down oxygen, it means they haven't changed their species. That's not how it works. I'm not sure. I think that was meant to be a profound question, but I think it's just been rumbled. Never mind.
This one from Hunter P. These are the last two folks. We gotta close it up. We're a bit over time already. Hunter P. says, robbing an old lady with a hammer is petty crime. Ha ha ha. I think that's for you, Kendon.
Well, yeah, but petty in the legal sense means it's small scale. I mean, if you're talking about, like, I don't know, like drug trafficking, that's not a petty crime because it involves a network of hundreds of, if not thousands of people. So that's a grand, that's a federal offence. But petty, if it's like localised, it's very small, it's intimate, an intimate crime, then that's considered petty. Yeah, so obviously it's still horrible for the old lady who gets smacked in the head with a hammer. I'm not arguing that point. But yeah, it's a legal, maybe it's not the legal, maybe I'm abusing the legal definition, but yeah, it's small scale is what I mean.
You got it.
Shoplifters of the world unite.
Yeah, exactly.
This one from, last one from Mars says, what outside of preference could say that life is something that quote unquote should be protected? I think they're kind of getting at the...
could you repeat that?
I think they're, they said, what outside of preference could say that life being protected is a should or something that should be done? I think they're kind of getting like, how do we get an ought from an is regarding, other than just preference, regarding the claim that life should be protected?
Well, I dare say that one could argue, why should we do anything? You know, why should Richard maintain his vision of the future? You know, it's a question of what you value, what feels right to you. I mean, to going back to the opening statement at the beginning, like the idea that reason is limited, you know, we do have feelings, we do have tastes and preferences. So I take one view, Richard takes another view. I don't think we can discern what should be done based entirely on rational means. Maybe there's some truth to that. I don't know. I don't believe
really in free will as it's conceived of by people, that we're a rational calculator that makes determinations. I think I'm driven by forces outside of my control, you could say. There's just something about me that wants this, and it's not something that I really kind of decide upon. And I think all human beings are like that. We're kind of part of a force.
You got it. Want to say, folks, our guests are linked in the description if you'd like to hear more about their views, and hope you felt welcome at Modern Day Debate. We're a neutral channel hosting debates on science, religion, and politics. With that, one last thank you to our guests, Richard and Kendon. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure was mine.
And,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kendon. I'll continue to watch your TikTok videos. You're the only person I follow.
Oh, well, I was going to say, I mean, you might not like, or you might not agree with all of them, but I would, if you could stand to be in my presence again, I would love to debate you again on another topic, if you fancy such a thing.
Well, if I'm ever allowed back in the United Kingdom, we can have a person-to-person debate. You should go bring that up with the Conservative Party that you're a member of.
I don't think I have that kind of sway. But yeah, if you ever fancy like doing, if you ever fancy going on Modern Day Debate again, I'm always ready and willing.
I'm down as well.
Thank you both, gentlemen. Cool. And I'll be back in just a moment, folks, with a post-credit scene letting you know about upcoming debates. So stick around for that.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.